Okay. Good morning, dear hearts. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. If you don't already have one, please pick up a periodical on the back table because it is full of theosophy, including the Declaration and the announcements. Declaration is on the back of everyone, and it's a statement, an affirmation of the policy of this lodge, if you would. We call it the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. It tells you that we are an association of students independently devoted to the cause of theosophy. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in true service to humanity, regardless of age, race, sex, creed, organization. And we welcome to this association all who are engaged in the true service of that humanity that we are a part of. Today, we are going to continue taking a look at the articles which were written and given by Robert Crosby in a 10-year period between 1909 and 1919. The article we're looking at today is called True Memory. We will have that part summarized. Actually, the first five paragraphs, I think there are 10 paragraphs in that part, in that talk. And we will have the first five parts of that talk summarized. I wanted to remind you that everyone here is a student. We are all volunteers. There is no remuneration or pittance given to anyone at this lodge. We have an example of that is a book table right behind us where you can buy straight line theosophical literature. And it's at our cost only. In front of the building, there is a library where you can pick up the study for that day and look up anything you'd like to. There's always a student there to help you in your search. Today, you obviously know that we have a meeting, and it is from 11 to 12, and it's sharp. It's 11 sharp to 12 sharp. And as I stated, we're studying the speech by Robert Crosby entitled Real Memory. In August, this is the last Sunday in July. In August, there are no Sunday meetings. We will pick up Sunday meetings again in September. However, Wednesday meetings are still on and will be continued. The study for Wednesday evenings is the Bhagavad Gita, a translation, if you would, by William Q. Judge. Speaking of memory. we are in chapter 3, I believe, we just finished chapter 3. We're going to chapter 4 now, right? Thank you. Our study classes on Wednesday night are from 7:30 to 8:30. The library is from 5:30 to 7:30, 5:15, if you want to be prompt, to 7:15. And before and after all meetings is that book table I previously told you about. Okay, now we do resume Sunday meetings next month. a month from now. Let me say that. Okay, I told you about students, and a student right now is going to give us a summary of the very first 5 paragraphs of the part for the night.
So Mr. Crosby's topic this morning is on real memory. And he starts out his article with this idea that there's a common misconception about memory, according to the teachings of theosophy. And he says that memory, the misconception is that memory depends on the proper functioning of the physical brain. And where there is not proper functioning of the physical brain, there is loss of memory. And he says that this is a misconception. There are different forms of memory. We'll talk about 3. The first 2 forms certainly do depend on the physical brain, those of remembrance and recollection. We remember things, we recall certain situations. In remembrance, the particulars of a past event or circumstance may evade us. With recollection, we may recall a particular idea from the past and then kind of connect other associated points with it and kind of collect them back together. That's why it's called recollection. Now, the third function of memory is known as reminiscence. And from a theosophical perspective, reminiscence is not dependent upon the brain. It is used quite frequently, and reminiscence springs directly from the soul itself. Reminiscence is the direct perception of that which was. It is behind, or it's beyond, the physical brain, and it uses the physical brain as a tool to translate the impressions of the reminiscence, of the memory. Within this process of reminiscence are the associated faculties of recollection and remembrance within reminiscence, which is slightly different from the ones dependent on the brain. We think he's making a distinguishment there. Within the process of reminiscence, okay, are these inner associated faculties of remembering and recalling all past conditions in such a way as to synthesize those past impressions. And this is a faculty of memory applied by the soul. It's an innate quality of the soul. He tells us that as we come to more clearly understand our own real nature and think and act from our own real nature, we develop the ability to more fully exercise soul memory. But first, we must recognize and accept that all beings, above and below man, are of the same potential powers. All beings are of the same essence. This is a prerequisite to recognize and accept this to the development of soul memory or reminiscence. Some beings have more so developed the potential into a potency, and therefore beings vary by degree. But they don't vary in their essential nature or in their potential. All beings are from and one with the divine. Each is the center of the universe through which alone all can be known. So that's first. Seems like a prerequisite, he's saying, that we recognize the divine and the common potentiality of all beings. The second, he says, is that we must also come to accept that ours is a universe of law. There are no accidents anywhere. The very operations of man is according to the laws of his own being. Such is the case throughout nature. We who now exist as a human family are the result of races of men in the vast past. We were those races of men. Our planet is the result of a planet which preceded it, as well as the solar system. All is the exact consequences of that which preceded it, plus the wisdom gained from the previous repetition. The return of impressions, then, is the true aspect of memory. The repetition of things that are today is brought about by our very soul memory, on a soul level, that which we have experienced from the past. The action of soul memory on the physical plane is repeated in all stages through which the human form goes, from the single cell all the way up to infant, while in the mother's womb. This is a repetition of the very evolution of the earlier races through which we have all evolved. True memory is expressed by us in every act of our existence, whether we know it or not. True memory connects us to this very physical body through all the varying conditions. Without true memory, we would merely be living from impression to impression without the capacity to synthesize present circumstances with past impressions. Therefore, we would not have a sense of self-identity. Memory exists throughout our nature. Ideas connected with the physical plane distract us from inner. Ideas connected with this physical plane distract our attention from inner planes of being. Just as when we're asleep, we're unaware of the outside world unless a distraction awakens us. Nevertheless, there is an active life in the inner departments of our nature, and there is a memory of the inner departments of our nature. Every plane of consciousness has a memory of its own. The masters recall their true memory within every department of their nature. Therefore, they have the knowledge of all that every human being has experienced in the past. They recognize the guiding laws ruling our very evolution. They record as much knowledge as we can assimilate by the proper use and benefit for others, so that all humanity may advance in such a way that results in greater and greater individualization and wider range of perception, as well as the right discernment of the two paths of evolution, that which leads to greater individualization, which is on a selfish basis, and the other where there is no cessation for work for humanity. With true memory, we recognize the path that they show, and that which involves the power of direct cognition of truth of the truth of things, which includes real memory.
So I hope you all understood that. Three types of memory. Let me give you a little example. Remembrance, brain driven. As just stated, driven by a feeling, an event, an object, a sound, a color, a taste, but it's not as good as recollection. An example, I remember the song that's playing. I was driving a used 65 Chevy, or maybe it was a new 68 Plymouth. Anyway, I had just crossed state lines, driving from Pennsylvania to Ohio. Well, maybe it was Pennsylvania to West Virginia. I can't remember that. Anyway, I think that's the last time I heard that song. Or maybe it was the first time I heard that song. I don't quite remember. And recollection is a little different. Recollection is driven by a need to know. It's kind of like you're painfully trying to recall something. Here's an example. The last time you wore that shirt, you took me to a little restaurant in Erie, Pennsylvania. It was lightly snowing and very cold. The restaurant had the prettiest blue napkins, and we sat three tables from the front door. You had the French toast and remarked how good it was. Every detail was recalled. That's recollection as opposed to remembrance. I hope that helps clarify the two of them. The third one, anybody's guess, in the back. Everything is an exact consequence of that which preceded it. That's cause and effect. That is karma, right? Everything is a repetition of that which was. That's also karma. There's nothing, you've heard that there's nothing new under the sun, and that you create your own world. That's what it's saying. When you repeat something, you can't expect a different reaction if you're repeating the same. The consequences are going to be the same from you repeating something exactly as it was before. In the back.
And the following sentence, if you read that, answers why that's memory.
Oh. This return of the same action or preceding impression occurs under the true aspect of memory. It is the memory of what we have been through that brings us about the repetition. Yes.
We read somewhere a student's expression that all growth comes from soul knowledge, which is memory. Exchanging the memory we have for a higher one. We didn't put that very well, but it's that it's two kinds of memory, that of the soul and that of the personal or the cellular or the physical. So we're always battling our own memory unless we take charge.
Yeah, we know, it's like we know what to do in any given circumstances because we've had memory of similar circumstances or witness circumstances other people may have had. Or in somewhere it comes to us that what will happen if we proceed in a given way. And that's not because it happened to us or we have done it. It's because we have that soul memory that tells us. You know, when you look through your eyes, your individual sees, as well the individual sees and perceives, so does the soul through those same eyes. Yes. Yes.
Holder of all the past learning and knowledge and
It does sound like intuition, doesn't it? I guess great minds think alike. I had the same exact question. I could not in my head delineate the two, reminiscence and intuition. What I had come up with in answer to them, I wrote down, so I wouldn't forget. I think intuition is looking for an answer, an explanation, a sense of what to do, whereas reminiscence is from the past. The past as the soul experienced it, and the memory is uncolored by the brain receiving it through the intuition. So it's kind of like a line is drawn in the sand, and over here you have the past, and that's reminiscence. And over here you have the future and the present, and that's more of intuition. Yes?
Then what part of our nature holds all this knowledge that we can express through intuition?
What part of our nature? Well, all the memories of thoughts, words, deeds that we have expended are forever locked in the astral light. And I believe that's what you're referring to, are you not? The astral light? Mm-hmm.
Than any other part of our nature.
Right. That's the spiritual soul, the Buddhi. Yes, sir.
We think that the Bhagavad Gita, generally the one of the first texts that we come in contact with, the use of the drama is broken down into several parts, and the principal act in the play have names, Krishna, and once you become familiar with those names and follow their activity, you get some light on the idea of what memory is, who is the actor, what is in action, what is generation.
Yeah, we're studying that in depth on Wednesday evenings. That's part in the Bhagavad Gita. The two main characters are Krishna and Arjuna. Krishna represents our higher self, that individuality, and it is that spark of every one of us that's connected to the deity of all. You had your hand up?
With respect to intuition, to discern what's the difference between intuition and real memory,
yeah.
What comes to mind is perhaps real memory is the direct cognition of that which was. Intuition is not a searching for the right answer. Intuition is the direct cognition of what the right thing is to do. You see? So the use of intuition is a soul power just as memory is a soul power.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking also really about repetition. Why does everything repeat? Why does it happen? Well, in the part, we are told that the object of evolution, the purpose of the effect of evolution is that each being will become more and more individualized and their potential will grow, their potency will grow wider and wider. And this is only going to happen if they continue to grow and learn the law, the pro-
hopefully that's true, that you do bring forth that knowledge.
That was our next, the thing is, there could be a lot of missed opportunities to gain wisdom through a given repetition, and therefore you're not going to learn as much. Mr. Crosby in the part toward the end of the part says, very interesting, he says, the masters, you know everything and preserve in Buddhi, universal Buddhi, everything that we can assimilate. It's what lessons do we assimilate from our actions? What lessons in our actions are worthy of real, you know, holding on to, and what gets cast out into the astral to be re-experienced and refined?
That's a good point. It makes no sense to think that you're moving up spiritually or gaining knowledge if you don't have the wisdom to grasp it and pull it forward along with what you already had. Yes.
But simply stated, the repetition is karma. It's cause and effect. And what comes back to us on all the levels of our consciousness has to be effects that we have, causes that we have put out there. So what we are struck by in this chapter is the fact that as spiritual beings, we have to cultivate our memories so that we can use the memory as a tool. I would think that's what Mr. Crosby is getting at. Is that,
mm-hmm.
That everything has to be a conscious choice.
It is a conscious choice, and that's how you change your karma for the future. But the two tie together. You make a conscious effort to gain that wisdom and knowledge and move on. And in the future, if not one of the types of karma is immediate karma, you will experience better karma in a future life. Yes. Yeah, and speaking of memory, there's a very famous quote, I can't think of who said it, if we don't pay attention to history, we're doomed to repeat it. It's kind of the same exact thing. Yes?
In terms of reminiscence, we've always wondered why we came here, why what it was that brought us here, that we know that before coming here, we had a lot of questions. Asking a lot of questions about life, and we were very unsettled. And then, lo and behold, one day we found ourselves here. Now, it wasn't a matter of recollection. It wasn't a matter of remembrance. It had to be a reminiscence of our being, that of something that we have done in the past. Really made a great impression on us, so that we keep on struggling to be a part of it.
Right. It's like everybody in your life presently has been a part of your life in the past, in past lives. Your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, the people you work with, the people you supervise. The guy driving the bus that you see every day, they've all been a part of your life in other lives. And somehow, as in part of your life, you meet somebody and instantly you have a great fondness for them. Where'd that come from? You don't know them from Adam. It's the first time you've seen them. But you have a fondness for them. And the opposite of that is, you walk into a room and across the hall, across the room is somebody, and you look at them and you say, I don't like that guy. I wonder why. I've never seen him before. Where'd that come from? It's remembrance of a past memory of a previous life, perhaps, which is more than likely the case. So you're talking about the same thing. You've run across theosophy, the wisdom of the ages, somewhere in a past life or in an earlier year when you were 6 months old, 8 months old, 7 years old, but you don't recall that, you don't remember that, but you heard it mentioned, some people were talking about it, but it stuck with you. And it came to fruition when you reached 39. Oh, 37, sorry. Yes.
And to the extent that we apply ourselves to learning it and sharing it with others, we'll find it sooner next time. We won't have to wait until we've made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, mistakes are just opportunities to learn. And hopefully we do learn from the mistakes, because they can get very, very costly. Yes.
I think one of the talks recently, someone quoted from Einstein, and it was basically that love is the great conqueror of all, and that very sentiment of connecting with that love has to be reminiscence, I would think, because we are all that, but we have turned away, and we think we're separate, and we think that we're different or unique, you know, or that we know more, and all these kinds of things. But when we love someone, that feeling, like, it spreads all around you, because it's mm-hmm. not, you can't, once you open your heart up to that person, when in that room or when in you, it's there for everyone. So I think that's maybe our lasting salvation.
I don't know about salvation, but love rules the world. I mean, everything revolves around. That is the hidden power of the world. It's a individual compassion, individualized compassion, I would say, for another, and that's has to be from reminiscence. Only can we change by love. I have to think about that, put that in my memories. But it sure sounds right off the bat. Hold one more.
In the Tao, it says, the good he greets with good, the bad he greets the same, for thus is goodness understood by one who knows its name. And it's the same thing. Only love can cure unlove.
Yeah, I would say that's absolutely right. Only love can cure unlove. Yeah, and it's undying compassion expressed as love. I didn't mention it. Go ahead.
Because Mr. Crosby mentions salvation in the part, and he says to recover the whole memory, to make the great knowledge of the past usable here and now in the brain and in the body is the true work of salvation. And we just thought it was kind of an, I mean,
when we think of salvation, we think of, you know, being saved. And being able to remember everything, we were trying to figure out how is that being saved. You know, it was just kind of an interesting sentence, the way he had it phrased, that being able to remember everything is salvation.
Yeah, it's an interesting word. You had a comment on this question?
Right. So, not just in Christianity, but in philosophy and religion generally, the word salvation is kind of synonymous with immortal life. How you get there is different among the different religions, that the teachings are different. But the word salvation has the same implications. It's been interpreted in Christianity as being saved by Jesus. But a better understanding for the theosophist is more, if you think of the word salvation, think of the word salve, the way it blends into your skin. Think of the word saliva. The saliva breaks down bread and it will assimilate into your tongue and your mouth. The bread will assimilate immediately, so it's an assimilation. So the human being, when we assimilate back with the all, that's our salvation. I think Mr. Judge also talks about that in the Raja Yoga article.
Thank you. In the back.
That sentence that was read, to recover the whole memory, isn't what we think it is, the memory of all our personal experiences. It is said that after the death of this personality, what we're left with is the cream of that life, everything we were able to bring into Buddhi or that higher consciousness. So the whole memory is the memory that includes our unity with all life, not just all humans, and the various stages of evolution that as souls we've had to go through. So it includes the whole. It isn't personal memory.
Okay, that's the differentiation that you're talking about, including all, not just individual. Yes, sir.
In paragraph 7, which we didn't read, I think that's interesting. On the last line, when we're speaking about consciousness never cease, it's a continuous activity, and then that line, when we say I was asleep, we mean that the body was in the state of sleeping. While we passed away altogether from this plane for the time being. And then it says, then we passed back from the inner planes to this, picking up memory of the waking state where we left it. And I think that's interesting, that explanation is that the brain that we have in this lifetime has not been trained in that direction of having the pure cognition of going from one state to another. It hasn't been trained yet at this part of our development. So it can only pick up when it's out in this physical waking state. And because we talk about our dreams and we know we're consciously going through situations there. Sometimes we remember, sometimes we don't. So I think that tie-in with this idea that consciousness never ceases, disregard what the state is of this physical form.
So the point you're trying to make then is that we are at all times conscious, whether we're asleep or not?
These buildings around us, particularly this old one,
Where did we get?
The state of that park millions of years ago. And why is it that the way it looks today, we call it a human being? Creation?
I'm not sure I understood the question. Was the question, where did we get the appreciation for great nature? Is that?
Where did we get the ability to construct all of these beautiful buildings around us?
Oh, okay, okay. Where did we get the ability to build, to make, to manufacture, to create? Whether it be a building or a work of art or a great masterpiece of music. That's the expansion of your question. You want to answer that? Okay.
Well, yes, it goes back to the very basics. We are beings of light. That's from which everything comes. And the only problem that we have is that we've covered that light up. Covered in this clay that's dark and viscid, and we can't see out until we make an effort to break away the clay and let that light shine through us and in us.
Right. I think there's an adage that says we are not humans on a spiritual journey. We are spirits through this human journey.
Should also remember we are in this clay for a purpose. We came here to increase our own knowledge and experience and to help the intelligence in the lower kingdoms be inspired to come up. So the clay isn't a problem. The clay is the school, and we have to work through that school.
Yeah, it's a piece of the equipment we were given in order to advance ourselves.
Two things we think we heard in the question. The first being that while here we have become so enmeshed in physical matter and the senses and the material world that we forget the end of paragraph 8. Only when we gain the perception that we are the eternal spirit, that death never touches us at all, that we may have a conscious light in spirit, not in matter. Only when we begin to think and act from that basis can true memory come through to the brain.
Yeah, it goes on to say that true memory is possible for every living being. But that's the way you get it, in that sentence you just read. Clarification?
Yeah. Anyone that's ever seen the Pitta Tata in Rome, it's a beautiful statue, female figure, and holding in her arms the male figure. And it seems to so that we can see that she is addressing the reverse to us. Wake up.
That can be that statue could be a metaphor for many things, many things. But I like that thought. It could be about reminiscence as well. Wake unto me. Let me have more of it. What do I have to do to get more? To bring it forward. Yes.
As if the female is nature itself, and the male or the or that aspect is asleep.
It's all humanity.
And us individually, that, that there's something that's waiting.
Yeah, you can take that to mean a lot of things. It's a beautiful statue. Yes.
But isn't it Mary holding her deceased son, the dead body? Isn't that, I mean, you can take whatever you want out of art, but
yeah,
that's, you know, you have to also look at what he was commissioned to do.
Well, you give them free license to create.
Earlier we were talking about salvation, and we were thinking also salvage. We're salvaging that which we have lost. And, you know,
we're trying to reconstruct. We're trying to bring it back. That's right.
In that sense, another helpful word to gain a grasp of this idea of salvation is the word justification. That we don't see it used too much in theosophy, but justification as in all caps. And what we found interesting about that, you know, that a soul is justified, reaches justification, and is therefore fully immortal, so to speak. But what we think is interesting is the word justification has a very specific implication in the law. So it's when that human being has balanced his karma, he is fully justified. And that, or saved, or has reached salvation.
And what you're saying is then you're fully justified to become more.
The idea that's taught is by academics, not specific, is this word justification is used as that's it, you're there, you are justified, and you know, you're justified in the universe, or anything else.
Strictly as a descriptor.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
It's an interesting paradox that if any one of us as an individual is going after salvation, then we're not going to get what we think is salvation. The object is to serve the whole, and we do that by doing our best where we find ourselves. So if our goal is for ourselves, that's selfish, and it's self-defeating.
That's the number one sin, selfishness. Yes.
Well, it's funny because we see every religion in the world, they're justified in killing the infidel. They're justified in going to war. They're justified. And it's how it's interpreted and in what environment it's used. Because if we feel justified, we become like them, self-righteous, that we know the answer. We know it. You don't have to tell me, I know it. And that's what's wrong with religion. You know, there's not that open-mindedness. At some point, the mind shuts down and thinks that it knows. And therefore, it stops looking. It stops feeling, because it knows the truth. So, from a personal point of view, it's always colored.
Yeah, it's... 1 minute. It's about buying into that dogma of these religions instead of free thinking. You buy into the rewards that you will receive. It's all about rewards. You're going to get eternal life if you just listen to me and do what I say. I printed it right here. Just read it, do it. You're going
to
be good.
Yeah. That is one of the reasons why when the secret doctrine was written, the purpose was to get people to think. So if you come into these rooms looking for the answer, you're wasting your time. But if you're looking to find how you can find the answer and how you can develop your own capacities, you know, however we can help.
Independent Association of Free Thinking Students. Independently studying on their own, as well as in meetings like this. Yes.
So, where is the safeguard if each of us is
we're each individually endangered, that we might have the wrong perceptions, or we might hold the wrong premises and be self-deluded. Is it in the gathering such as this, where we compare what we remember and compare what we perceive and try to see if it's correct?
Yeah, a meeting like this is like a train yard where you have to get back on the right track. And by listening to other thoughts and ideas on the same particular subject that you're looking at, you can find a different way of looking at an idea or thought. Yes.
The chair's first opening comments.
I don't remember that.
about true memory.
Yes.
The fact that we are sitting here talking with each other, moving about, asking questions, saying, aha, I see. But we do that automatically, don't we?
I missed something.
Don't
we do what automatically?
We do that automatically.
Oh, sitting.
And your comments was to indicate what it looks like when we can't remember. But we remember to get up, put our clothes on, come in, we go out. We don't even think about it. Where is that ability?
Oh. Well, every part of your body has memory. Every part has its own memory. You don't have to tell, a pianist doesn't have to tell his fingers. They have a memory from repetition, from rote, and the memory in those fingers know what keys to push and all that kind of stuff. A typist doesn't need to look at the keys. Typewriters are obsolete now, showing my age. But your body, every cell in your body has a memory. Every cell in your body, your arms, everywhere. I mean, when you take a pill, for instance, how does that pill know where to go in your body? You know, it has, your body tells it where to go. It drops into the stomach. The stomach says, what do I do with it now? Other parts of your body call for it. Say, come over here. I need you over here. Memory. It's all about memory. What we know about memory, you could put on the head of a pinhead, I think. I was reading an article by Judge, William Q. Judge. I can't remember the title. It wasn't about memory, however. It was about the astral light. And in that, he talks about memory briefly. And he says, we know as much about memory as we know about Antarctica. Remember, this was written in, can't remember the year, but I can get away with saying the late 19th century. Yes.
There's an important lesson to be learned in that fact of memory, like the typist or the pianist. We are teaching the instrument. And in doing so, it then can run independently, so we can be busy doing other things. Anyone who plays the piano or types knows that if they interfere with the hands and the memory, they start making mistakes. So we have to realize we have the ability to commit these very ideas into memory within our own personal nature. So we stop having the same problems. It's a question of creating better memories.
You don't have to tell your eyes to blink, do you? It keeps your eyes damp and able to move freely, lubricates. You don't have to tell your body to do that. It's automatic. The body is probably the biggest example you could ever think of multitasking. It's just everything in your body is going on at once. And yet it does it very well. And it's learned behavior. And you taught it. We all taught it. We're going to be closing very soon. I wanted to read something in closing to you. Let's see. This is paragraph 9 in the part. The barrier for every man is not in the memory, but in the false ideas of life according to which he acts. However much the soul remembers, if we are using the brain contrary to the nature of the soul, the brain cannot translate its impressions. The thinker must transfer the memory of the soul to the brain, and he can do so only by thinking and acting along right lines and during active waking consciousness until the brain responds to the ideas and learns to transmit what occurs while the body is inoperative. Then the true memory of the past, that is the soul in our knowledge, that is in the soul, is our knowledge in the brain. One last question. Well, I'll just say in closing that we have to be careful about everything we say. Words are very powerful when expressed. They not only maintain the power as they come out of our lips, but that power goes on and on and on. Meeting is adjourned.
Meeting over.
It's over. I said that. Turkey.